Parshas Shkolim, which is the first of the four special kriyas that we make prior to Pesach. It's one Shabbos that we read as Maftir, the Parshas Shkolim. Then there's Parsha Zocher, when we read the Parsha of Zechiras Mechiras Amalek. Then there's Parshas Parah, which is after Purim, when we read about the preparation and the concept of the Parah Aduma. And then Parshas HaChodesh, which deals with the concept of Chodesh. And the takona that one reads Parsha Shkolim either on the Shabbos before Rish Chodesh Adar, as it comes out this year, we'll be reading a Mitzvah Shem Parsha Shkolim this Shabbos, and Rish Chodesh Adar will be Sunday and Monday, if I'm not mistaken. Or alternatively, that one reads Parsha Shkolim on the Shabbos of Rish Chodesh Adar, if theoretically Rish Chodesh Adar would work out to be Shabbos, is a takona which the Gemara tells us. It's a Gemara in Megillah, towards the end of Megillah, in fact the very end of Maseches Megillah. It's a takona which the Chazal were masakin already in the time of the Bayis Sheni. Right? This takona was initiated at the time of the second Beis Hamikdash, and the purpose of the takona, according to Chazal, was that everyone should remember that he has an obligation to donate his half a shekel to the treasury of the Beis HaMikdash during the month of Adar, in order that by the end of Chodesh Adar, which is the beginning of Nisan, by that time there should be enough money in the Beis HaMikdash bank account that there should be the possibility of bringing the communal korbanos that had to be bought, that had to be brought in the Beis HaMikdash, and which were purchased from communal money, from money donated by the individuals in Klal Yisrael, that from Rish Chodesh Nisan and onwards, that those korbanos would be purchased from the new money that was the new, which was raised by the annual appeal of everybody giving a half a shekel to the Beis HaMikdash. Because we learn out from the Pasuk that every year they had to renew the coffers of the Beis HaMikdash, they had to renew the money that the Beis HaMikdash had for the Korbanos HaTzibur. And from Rish Chodesh Nisan and onwards, the Korbanos had to be brought from the new money that was raised. Therefore, this money had to be put together during the month preceding Rish Chodesh Nisan, and the month preceding Rish Chodesh Nisan is Adar, and therefore the collection took place during the month of Adar, and therefore on Rish Chodesh Adar we read Parsha Shkolim to remind everybody, get your finances into some sort of order in order that you should be able to donate your half a shekel to the Beis HaMikdash. And after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, after the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and therefore in reality there's no point anymore in reading the Parsha of Shkolim, because there's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no Beis HaMikdash treasury, and there's no Korbanos HaTzibur, and there's no point in collecting the money, and the money taki isn't collected. So why do we carry on reading Parsha Shkolim on the Shabbos before Rish Chodesh Adar? So the Gemara says in Megillah, because it's a zeicher lemikdash sheyibane b'mheira, right? It's a commemoration of what was done in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and the reason why we do it is with the hope that achakalei b'chol yom sheyovoi, right? we believe the Emunah Shleima that Mashiach will come at any moment, in which case there will be a Beis HaMikdash which will function again, and therefore, on the basis of this, we read the Parsha Shkolim either, as we said, on the Shabbos prior to Rosh Chodesh Nisan as this year, or on the Shabbos of Rosh Chodesh Nisan, either on the Shabbos prior to Rosh Chodesh Adar, or on the Shabbos which is Rosh Chodesh Adar, if Rosh Chodesh Adar comes out on a Shabbos. However, if you learn the Seches Megillah, which some of you may have done, you find in the Gemara Megillah a further understanding as to what is the connection between the reading of Parsha Shkolim prior to Rosh Chodesh Adar and the month of Adar. Because the Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yud Gimel, right, the previous Gemara we quoted was at the end of Megillah on Daf Kaftes. There's a previous Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yud Gimel where the Gemara brings a statement from Reish Lakish. And the Gemara says that Reish Lakish said, Golui v'yadua lifnei mi she'omar v'hoya ha'olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam, Kavyachol, knew she'osid Haman lishkel shkolim al Yisrael. That Haman was going to use the vehicle of shkolim in order to try and destroy Klal Yisrael. Lefichach, therefore the Ribbono Shel Olam hikdim shikleihen lishkolov, made sure that Klal Yisrael should give Shkolim before Haman would give his Shkolim. V'hainu disnan, and that's the reason why the Mishnah says Be'echad bi'adar, that on Rosh Chodesh Adar Mashmim ala Shkolim, you announce and remind everybody that they have to give their Machtzis HaShekel. And obviously the Mefarshim on the Gemara already discussed this. What is the connection between the shkolim that Haman was going to give Achashverosh in order to bribe him to allow him to destroy Klal Yisrael and the shkolim which are given to the Beis HaMikdash and which we announce by reading the Parsha Shkolim prior to Rosh Chodesh Adar? And we find in Megillas Esther something very strange, or at least at first glance it seems very strange. I think most of us know, or remember from kindergarten days, the basic outline of the story of Purim. It would be too much to assume that anybody's actually learnt Megillas Esther after they left kindergarten, but certainly some of you may remember from that point in time. There's a very interesting event that is recorded in the third Perek of Megillas Esther. And the Megillah says the following, that Haman arranges a meeting with Achashverosh. And in this meeting, a conversation takes place between Haman and Achashverosh. Vayema Haman lemelech Achashverosh, Haman says to Achashverosh, Yeshnei am echad mefuza u'mefeired bein ha'amim b'kol medinois malchusecha. There's a certain nation, there's a certain people that are scattered around, are dispersed in amongst everybody else or the other inhabitants of your empire. V'dosehem shoinois mikol om. And they have different laws than everybody else, right? This week's Parsha, Parsha's Mishpatim, right? Jews have different laws than non-Jews. V'yesdosei ha-melech einom oisim. And they don't even keep the laws of the country, right? Basic anti-Semitic argument that comes up every decade. Ulemelech ein shayve lahanicham. Therefore, it's not right that you're tolerating this people to exist. Im alamelech taif, if the idea pleases you, Yikosev la'abdom. Make a decree to wipe them out. And by the way, v'yaseres alofim kikar kesef, and I'll pay you eshkol al yidei oisem malach alahavir ginzei amelech. And I'll make sure that you get deposited in your account 10,000 kikrei kesef. Now, 10,000 kikrei kesef is a huge amount of money. In fact, even though the cheshbon is somewhat difficult to understand, and there's a lot of discussion amongst the Rishonim on the Seches Megillah as to how this cheshbon works, because it doesn't quite stim, it doesn't quite fit. But leaving that aside for a moment, the Chazal, according to Tosfos in Megillah, on Daf Tezayin on Medalef, Tosfos maintains, and again I repeat, the cheshbon is not so simple how Tosfos got to this, and there's a lot of kashas on it, but Tosfos says it, Al Kopolim, so some sort of hesbah there should be in Tosfos, that the 10,000 kikrei kesef is the equivalent of the entire sum of the chatzi shekel that Klal Yisrael donated to the Beis HaMikdash. And the reason why the cheshbon is difficult is because if you assume that the Klal Yisrael, the first time the Masses HaShekel were given was 600,000 people, the cheshbon doesn't quite fit. But Al Koponim, Tosfos says this. In other words, it's an enormous, it was an astronomic sum of money. If I recollect correctly, somewhere in the writings of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, if I'm not mistaken, it is in Alatera, in connection with the different sums of money that are paid for different damages, etc., which are done, he makes there a cheshbon of how you can work out bizman hazeh, how much money this would be, because it all depends on the weight of silver, and you can just look in the newspaper every day and you'll see, right, the silver rates, and you can work out how much it is, and he works it out there, and once I made the cheshbon, it comes out to be an astronomic sum of money that Haman was willing to pay, basically seemingly as a bribe to Achashverosh, in order to allow him to destroy Klal Yisrael. And the response of Achashverosh to Haman is Vayema Melech Lahoman Akesem Nosan Loch Vahom Lasis Bekatei Benecha. I mean, don't worry about the money. I would even go along with your plan even without getting the money. You don't have to bribe me in order to convince me to make this decree against Klal Yisrael. I would even do it without getting the money. And when you read the Megillah and you read these psukim, the impression that one gets is that this plays a very, very minor role in the whole story of Purim. In other words, there's a whole story going on here. There's a story with a king and a queen, and then king knocks the queen's head off, and then he has to find another queen, and then he does a Miss Universe contest, and finally finds another queen, and then then there's a decree, and then there's a Mordechai, who's an uncle, and he doesn't know he's an uncle. Against the Maisa, the fact that Haman was willing to bribe Achashverosh in order to implement the decree against Klal Yisrael doesn't seem to be one of the major issues in the Megillas Esther. It happens to be a very sort of like minor piece of information that this guy was such a rusher that he was even willing to pay a huge sum of money in order to destroy Klal Yisrael, and the whole reason why he wanted to destroy Klal Yisrael was because basically he got a bit upset with a guy called Mordechai, which may indicate that he was a stickle paranoiac, maybe. But certainly doesn't seem to be an integral part of the whole mess and the whole story. However, when you then carry on reading the Megillah, and you just move on, not very many psukim, you just enter into the next chapter in the Megillah, There's a further story told there. And here the situation gets a little bit complicated. Why? Because Mordechai finds out about this, and he sends a message to Esther about this. And the result of that is the following. The pasuk says that Esther had a guy who was I don't know how you want to call it, he was the English translations call him a chamberlain, whatever that means. He was a shamus, right? He was one of her servants. And his name was Hasoch. And she told him, she sent this guy Hasoch to Mordechai. And he went out to Mordechai. And she said to Hasoch, go find out from Mordechai all the details of what's going on. What's happening here? So Hasoch goes on the instructions of Esther to Mordechai to ask Mordechai, give me the details of what's going on. I need to know the important points. You want me to intervene here and to do something with Achashverosh. In order that this decree should not be implemented, I have to know the background. So tell me the important points that I should know in order that I should be able to my approach as to how I'm going to handle this. Vayaged lo Mordechai, so Mordechai tells Hasoch, Eskol asher korahu, everything that happened. And according to Chazal, Eskol asher korahu, is he tells him over all the details of the decree that Haman is trying to make against Klal Yisrael. The es parashas hakesef, Asher Oma Homon Lishkel Al Ginzei Ameler by Yehudim Liabdom. And he tells him over separately the story that Homon was willing to give money to Achashverosh in order to implement this decree, which seems to indicate that the fact that Homon was willing to give Mordechai money to implement the decree in itself constitutes a major, major issue here in this whole story. Because that's what the pasuk says. The pasuk says that Mordechai told her over everything, all the details of what went on with Haman and Achashverosh. And then separately the pasuk says, and besides all that, he told him, and what's the punchline? Parshas HaKesef. The fact that Haman was willing to pay Achashverosh to allow him to destroy Klal Yisrael. And this seems to give us the understanding that the fact that Haman was willing to pay Achashverosh is something which presents a tremendous problem, and it's a major, major, major component of the whole story. Ad kidei kach, that Chazal have to come along, and Chazal have to say that the whole reason why Klal Yisrael have to be careful about the mitzvah of Machzit HaShekel is in order to act as a counterattack to the money that Haman was willing to give to Achashverosh. And in fact, the money that Klal Yisrael are giving as a Chatzi Shekel, the Master Shekel, has to come before the 14th of Adar, when Haman was going to give the money to Achashverosh. Why? Because otherwise it can't act as a deterrent. It has to block the concept of the money that Haman was going to give to Achashverosh. In other words, the giving of the money by Haman to Achashverosh, that's something which somehow intensified the whole Gzeirah and made it so dangerous. Without Haman giving the money, the Gzeirah would never have been so dangerous at all. It was the money that he gave, that's what made the whole thing into a major, major, major problem, into a major sakona. And what's the logic in that? What is the power in the fact that the guy was willing to bribe the government that they should do what he wanted them to do? In modern day terms, he'd be called a lobbyist. What's the great avera in that? There's a halacha in the Torah. And halacha in the Torah is Timcha Zecher HaMolech. That the Jew has a obligation to destroy a Molech. It's one of the strangest halachas that appear in the Torah. You come across a Molechi, right, it's Machlekes Rishonim, whether it has to be in a war, or whether it applies to an individual who happens to meet the odd Amaleki, if you happen to bump into one, and can identify him, you have an obligation to kill him. And in fact, you have an obligation of genocide. You have an obligation to wipe out the entire Amaleki population, males, females, children, everybody. Why? And what does the Torah say? The Torah says, well, there was a story that took place. The story took place a long time ago, that when Klal Yisrael were coming out of Egypt, there was a nation called Amalekim who attacked Klal Yisrael. So, 2,500 years later, or however much it is, right, or 2,000 years later, you have an Amaleki, he's your next door neighbor, he's a very nice next door neighbor, and you have an obligation to kill him. Why have you got an obligation to kill him? Because who knows how many hundreds of generations ago he had a great 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 grandfather who did an Avla. What's the logic in that? Hello. Obviously, there is some rishus in essence that exists within Amalek. There is something negative that exists within Amalek, which the Torah determined cannot be solved, and therefore Amalek has no schus to exist. And whatever it is that existed in the original Amalek genetically goes down from one generation to the next generation. There is some sort of evil spiritual genetics in Amalek which is going down from generation to generation. And somehow this negative spiritual genetic doesn't disappear on its own accord. And it won't disappear unless you physically destroy the Keli in which this spiritual negative genetic exists, namely the Amaleki person, the Amaleki individual. Because there is no hope of ever being able to get rid of this negative force, whatever it is, without the physical destruction of the person who's carrying it. In the laws of genetics, one of the basics is, if you take, let's say, a tree, you take a plant, whatever it may be, that whatever exists in the future is already there in the seed. In other words, the seed contains the entire genetic construction and the entire power, if you want to call it that, for the continuation. And one of the ways in which they explain this to the layman is that, in the same way, we all understand that if you want to build a one floor building, you establish a foundation for the building. But the strength of the foundation for a one-floor building has to be, according to law, a certain strength. In other words, it has to be strong enough, and they will examine this, the engineers, has to be strong enough to carry one floor. If you're building a skyscraper, right, or if you're building something which is 100 floors, obviously the foundations that you have to lay for a building which is 100 floors is different than the foundations you lay for a building which is 10 floors, or for a building which is one floor. In other words, that the entire weight of the future construction that is going to be on this site has to be already implanted
in the foundation of the building, otherwise the foundation of the building won't be able to carry it and the building will collapse. And the same is true when it comes to spiritual things. When it comes to spiritual things, the foundation has to be powerful enough that it will carry the entire future structure, which is going to be on this foundation. And the same is true of negative things. Something which is spiritually negative, the development of the negativity is also dependent upon the koyach that there is in the source. In other words, the foundation, again, has to be strong enough to be able to allow the continuity in the future of the structure that you're building on this foundation. So if you want the ra, the evil, the negativity, to continue, you have to ensure that there is a very strong foundation for this negativity. However, we all know that the nature of the world is such that as generations go by, even if the original was extremely powerful and extremely pure, it'll go weaker as you move down from generation to generation. We have a general principle, right, that we use constantly. And the general principle we use constantly is, you can't talk in human terms about Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, right? Why not? And when the Torah does use everyday mundane descriptions of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you have to take it within its context, right? It's Dibur Torah Kolashim B'nei Adam, the Torah is trying to explain it to us, but the Chatoim, the sins of the others were different to our sins, etc., 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 etc. Why are we different from the others? Very simple. Because if you take the others as the starting point, whatever it was pure. Whatever it was totally the way it should be. The next generation had already, was already open to other factors that were going to play a role in the development of their personality. Environment, education, peers, siblings. So already it's not as pure as the first generation. Then you go down a further generation and it gets diluted even more, because again you've got education, environment, society, peers, siblings. And then you go down another generation and it gets even more diluted. So the nature of things is that if you, from your starting point, if you go down 50 generations, 60 generations, 70 generations, right, it's already diluted to the degree that it bears no comparison at all to the original. Therefore, at the end of the day, there becomes a very, very, very weak connection between, there becomes a very weak connection between the last generations and the origin of where it started from. There was a guy called Amalek. There was a nation called Amalek. They could have been the epitome of whatever it is that the Torah sees as being negativity. But by definition, if you're going to move down the generations, whatever that negativity was, it got weakened, and it got weakened, and it got weakened, and it got weakened. Why? Because Amalek was also open to influence. It was open to influence from society, from environment, from education, from peers, from siblings, from who knows what. And therefore there's no way in which you can say that 10 generations, 20 generations, 30 generations, 40 generations from the original Amalek, the Amaleki was as powerfully negative as the original Amalek was. In the same way as you can't lahavdil say that the Jew, right, today, is as powerfully spiritual as Avraham Avinu was, or as Yitzchak was, or as Yaakov was. Haman, say Chazal, was Mipnei Bonov Shel Amolek. He was the descendant of Amolek. And Chazal HaMadayek from the Psukim in Megillas Esther that Haman was, as it were, a clone of his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. I don't know how many greats you have to go to. I'm sure somebody will work it out. Or you can Google it, probably. How he was a clone. He was as powerfully negative as the original Amalek was. Which presents a question, how on earth could that be possible? As we just said, the nature of things is that as you get further away from the source, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. So how come that Haman was as powerful in his negativity, in his spiritual negativity, and his antithesis of Klal Yisrael, as the original Amalek was? When we talk about people who are giving type of people, they're people who like to contribute. And contribute doesn't necessarily mean money. They're people who like, they are people, they are nice things. They're people who like to give. They like to do for others. Right? On a material level, on a spiritual level, it doesn't make any difference. So, how do we view that? So one of the ways in which we describe somebody who is a giving person, we'll say, you know, he's a good-hearted fellow. Can I ask a favor from so-and-so? Yeah, you can ask him a favor. He's a good-hearted fellow. The other option that we always say is, can I get so-and-so to contribute to this tragic situation that arose? Yeah, he's a sensitive person. He'll understand what you're talking about, and he'll contribute. Right? Again, either in money or in time or whatever it may be. In other words, we assume that giving has something to do with good-heartedness or something to do with sensitivity. However, there's another angle which the Balei Musa talk about and the Chassidish Sforim talk about a lot, which we tend to overlook and we tend to ignore. And that is that a individual who is willing to give, whether it's of his time, whether it's of his money, whether it's of his actions, whether it's of his machshavas, it doesn't matter what. Any individual who's willing to do something for somebody else, who's willing to give, can only do that if in some way or other he's internally negating himself. Because man is born, created, right? The very nature of the human being is that his natia, his natural responses are, because we are material beings, right? We're not spiritual beings, we are physical material beings. Therefore, our natural inclination, our natural desires are that we want a prophet and two hanor. Every single person. Every single person by nature wants to profit and by nature wants to enjoy himself. If I have to give, which means that I have to lose something, I'm either losing from my profit, because every time I give, my profit goes down, or I'm losing from my hanor, because it's not always enjoyable to have to give or to have to do to another person, that means you are being mevater. You're being mevater either on yourself, or you're being mevater on your possessions, on your money. And therefore, giving always is a product of bittul atzmi. It's always a product of self-negation. You can't give unless to a certain degree you are going to negate yourself. Which is why the Torah says that when the Mishkan was established, it had to be established through contributions which Klal Yisrael were going to give of either gold or silver or copper. Because these are the three elements that a person desires the most. Gold, silver, copper constitute symbolically in the history of mankind wealth. And if we are trying to create a Mishkan, if we're trying to create something spiritual, a place where Shekhinah can rest, then the first thing you have to do is you have to make place for it. Because it can't exist within a person whose entire focus is Hana and profit. And how do you make room for Shekhinah? You make room for Shekhinah by destroying partially, or to a certain degree, that desire for Hana and that desire for profit. And how do you destroy the desire for Hana and the desire for profit? By giving. If you give, it's self-negation. That means it's negating yourself, the desires that you have, namely the desires for profit and the desires for Hana. And therefore, every mice in a sinner that a person does, every time a person contributes, every time a person gives, he is creating in himself the possibility of becoming something higher spiritually. Now Shlomo HaMelech says in Koheles that Zeh Le'uma Zeh Oso Elekim, that the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world in such a way that positivity and negativity work in exactly the same way. They just happen to be two sides of the scales. Which means that because a person was created with free will, because we are human beings, and the very, very definition of a human being is that as opposed to an animal, we have the right to choose. We don't react instinctively, but we have the right and the ability to choose, Bechira. Therefore, seeing that every individual can choose either L'Toiv or Chas V'Sholem in the other direction, every act of Bechira that we do can either be positive at the end of the day, or it can be negative at the end of the day. Therefore, it all depends on what your intent is. If the Koyach of Nesina is something which is mevatel the yeshus of the person, thereby raising him up. Raising him up means what? Making him more powerful. Then if your koyach hanesina is letoiv, for good reasons, then it raises the individual, and the individual becomes a more positive spiritual person. But if you use the koyach hanesina for a negative purpose, what does that do? It raises you up, it makes you a much more powerful spiritual person in the negative sense. And that's what was going on here. The natural course of events was such that because Haman was so many generations removed from Amalek, the power of Amalek should have weakened in Haman to such a degree that he shouldn't have been anything like Amalek in terms of his ability and his power of negativity. So Chazal were faced with a problem. How come that we see clearly that Haman's Amalekius, if you want to call it that, was as powerful as the original Amalek? The answer must be that he did something, or he was doing something, which was recreating this power, which was elevating him negatively to be as strong and as powerful as the original Amalek. What was he doing? Say Chazal, the fact that for his negative reasons, in order to destroy Klal Yisrael, he was willing to give away billions of dollars, he was willing to do that Maisa Nesina, that act of self-negation, that sacrifice, that recreated within him the ultimate negative spiritual level of the original Amalek. So in order to contrast that, in order to protect Klal Yisrael from that, what do we need? We need that Klal Yisrael should also be involved in an act of giving which will elevate them spiritually in a positive manner, that it should act as a contrast to what Amalek did. That's what Chazal tell us. Chazal say, Klal Yisrael have to get in there first. B'resh Chodesh Adar Mashmi'im Al Hashkolim. Give your contribution, your Nesina, and that will block the Nesina of Haman. Why? Because you will be elevated to a spiritual level in a positive way, which will act as a total deterrent for the negative spirituality of Haman. And here, if we use this principle, we find a very interesting thing. We find another very strange phenomena that exists in the Megillah. The Megillah says that part of the plan of Haman was that he was going to hang Mordechai. What was he going to hang him on? He was going to hang him on a gallows. How high were these gallows going to be? Chamishim Amo. But the problem was, when you get a pole which is 50 amas high. So Chazal tell us the following. Chazal say that Haman had in his house a pole, a plank of wood, which his sons had, which originated in the Teva. It originated in Noach's Teva. He destroyed the house, took out the pole, and set it up as a gallows. Say Chazal, that the Ribbono Shel Olam said, Yasu Eitz Gevoya Chamishim Amo. Haman decided to make a gallows of 50 amas high in order to hang Mordechai. The Ribbono Shel Olam said, no way. Why not? Uma ani oise li Avram. I'm never going to be able to face Avram Avinu again. Why? Because it says in the connection with Avram Avinu and the Malachim who Avram Avinu was machnes ayrach, right? Took them into his house. It says, "V'hu oimed aleihem tachas ha'etz." That Avram Avinu was serving them, these Arabs, that these Malachim who he thought were Arabs, right? Where was he doing it? Underneath the tree. The tree of Avram protects against the Gezerah of Haman. What on earth has the tree of Avram got to do with the Gezerah of Haman? And what's that got to do with the plank of wood which was taken from the Teva of Noach? And some of you guys, Rabbi Rubeloff maintains, are actually learning Megillah. There's a Tosfos in Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis in Megillah, where Tosfos says that when Haman said to Tosfos says this, not a Chassid Rebbe. Tosfos says this. That when Haman said to Achashverosh, HaKesef, when Achashverosh said to Haman, HaKesef Nosun Lecho, right? Keep your money. The gematria of HaKesef is the same as the gematria of Eitz. Eitz. How does this all connect up together? The pasuk says in Parshas Noach, when Noach gets the instruction to build the teva, the pasuk says, "Kimim tase la teva." You should make in the teva there's the instructions to Noach of how the Teva has to look.
and going to cover it in the inside and the outside with the gopher. And kinum tasas ateva has to be made with compartments. And Chazal say that the word kinim, whose root is the word kan, kuf nun, is also used in a different context. It's the pair of birds which the Metzora brings when he wants to be Metahir himself. It's called in the Torah, right? Kinim. Say Chazal, what's the connection? Why the same word? Say Chazal, that Amar Rav Yitzchok said, Maha kan hazeh metairas metzera, in the same way as the kan, the two birds, metairas and metzera, so too, the teva was metaher noach. In other words, the teva wasn't just a vehicle in which noach could be saved from the mabul, but the teva was also a kapora for noach. Why was the teva a kapora for noach, and why did noach need a kapora? So this is my Chazal. Chazal say that noach had a negative element about him. What was the negative element about Noach? Opposed to Avraham Avinu, who when God wanted to destroy Sodom, spent an inordinate amount of time arguing with God and being mispalel on behalf of Sodom, Noach was never mispalel on behalf of the people that they should be saved from the mabul. To which the Mefarshim say, maybe there's a good reason why Noach wasn't mispalel to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and in reference to the people. Maybe he thought that they're better off dying, because if they die a physical death before they do any more Averis, then at least they'll get their Olam Haba. Mutav she'yom zakai v'ayom v'schayev. To which Chazal say that, yeah, but the fact that they were so evil is also his fault, because he didn't try and be makarav of them in the way in which Avraham Avinu did. Avraham Avinu was makarav of them, he didn't try to be makarav of them. And the Sforno says that the Pasuk says that the reason why Noach was saved was because Noach motzo chen b'einei Hashem. So the Sforno, what does that mean? Noach found favor in the eyes of God. What's this favor business? So the Sforno says that chen is meloshin chanina, forgiveness, pardon. So the Sforno that really Noach should also have been killed in the mabul. And the fact that God saved him was a gesture on the part of God. And that's for Noach Motzo Chein Bein Hashem Chanini. It was a gesture on the part of God. So as a supporter, why should Noach have died? Because Noach suffered from the same problem as the Dor HaMabul did. What's the pshat? Because the Dor HaMabul, why were they destroyed? So Chazal say that even though they did many, many, many evil things, the reason why they were destroyed at the end of the day was because of theft. Because they stole from each other. In other words, they weren't willing to give. They only wanted to take. Noach was also a person who was lacking somewhere in his giving. Because if he really wanted to give, he would have been makarov, the people at the time, to give them what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. But he wasn't makarov them, and he wasn't mispalel for them. So that also is an element of being a non-giver. Therefore, he was also considered to be a chayta. Therefore, he needed a kapara. What was his kapara? Spend a year locked up with a load of animals that day and night you have to give. That day and night you have to give them. What was Avraham Avinu doing? He was being makarev people tachas kamtei hashchina. How was he doing it? So Chazal said the way he was doing it was by achnasas orchim. What's achnasas orchim? Giving. So the eighth of Avraham Avinu signifies and symbolizes giving. The teva of Noach symbolizes giving. When Haman gave, when Achashverosh also gave, when he said to Haman, you don't have to give me the money, I'm a vater. The Ribbono Shel Olam said, I can't do anything. I can't allow Achashverosh and Haman to get away with it. Why? Because I've got the deterrent. The deterrent is the eights of Avraham Avinu. That giving. The teva. That giving. The 50 yama pole from the teva. That giving. All that will protect Klal Yisrael. The I can't remember exactly where I saw this. But in one of the Mefarshim say that it's interesting that Klal Yisrael had to contribute to the Beis HaMikdash, so that Baruch Shalom tells them, give a chatzi shekel. Why? Why not give a complete shekel? Why give a half a shekel? So I saw somewhere that one of the Mefarshim says that the reason why it's a half a shekel is because a half indicates or symbolizes the fact that we're not complete, that we're missing something. We're only a half. We're only a fraction. We're not what we should be. And that's symbolized by the giving of the Machzis HaShekel. The Machzis HaShekel, as we saw, was a contrast. It was a deterrent for Gzeiris against us. Why is it a deterrent, as we said? Because it's the Sine, because it's giving. What's giving? Giving is self-negation. If you think, ponder a bit, and it's something that as the years go by, and as I spend more time in the walls of this place, Medrash, it becomes clearer and clearer to me that there's a Meiriki Yisayid here. And there's something that if we don't knock it into our minds, and we don't begin to understand it, and we don't even appreciate it, we will never become functional people in life. Because we will always, our entire lives, until our dying day, we will suffer in whatever we're doing. Forget about Torah, forget about Yiddishkeit, forget about Rabbani Shalom, anything that we're doing, whether it's in the work field, whether it's in the studying field, whether it's in the secular studying field, whether it's in married life, doesn't matter what it is. We're always going to suffer from this unless we do something about it. 99.9% of our problems start from ego, from the lack of the ability of Bittul Hayesh. We can't negate our own messed up ego. Because if you think about it, most of the time, when people are messing up, why are they messing up? They're messing up with a checklist of 20 mantras that constantly repeat itself. I always say, it's interesting, right? There must have been about, I don't know exactly what the list is, if we find it on the computer, but I would imagine somewhere in the region of this phone is holding like 500 and something. I think there are 530 or 560 alumni of Leivaria. Kishem Shepal Tzufei Hemenem Damus, they all look different, they're all dressed differently, each one was a different personality, right? No common theme. Leivaria is a motley collection of oddballs. That's what it is. But there is a common theme. And what's the common theme? Every year, they all walk in with the same checklist. Every year. With the same checklist of arguments as to why they're messing up. You don't know where I'm coming from, you don't know this, you don't know that, blah, 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 and all the rest of the garbage. And if you think about it, what's the shot? It all boils down to one thing. It all boils down to, don't tell me what to do, because I know better than you. And it expresses itself even in body language, and it expresses itself even in verbalization. You don't know where I'm coming from. Right? That already is the ultimate expression of Gaiva. That is the ultimate expression of Gaiva. In other words, I know better than you. That's Pshat Baal Gaiva. What's Pshat Baal Gaiva? Baal Gaiva is Pshat, don't tell me what to do because I know better than you. The fact that your brain power is 0.00001% of mine, the fact that your experience in life is 0.00000001 of mine, the fact that your age, right, and I'm talking not now about physical age, I'm talking about mental age, is 0.00000000000001 of mine. Right? I don't mean mine, me. Who are you talking to? Is it relevant to you? I don't mean you. I mean you. What is it? Right? But I know better. Because I know. I know what I can do and what I can't do. I know what I can handle and what I can't handle. I know what my... I know. The I know is not going to change when you leave the door of the Beis HaMedrash. It's not going to change in college when you're dealing with your lecturer. And it's not going to change in life when you're dealing with your wife. It's constantly going to be I know. And it's going to give a lot of pranasa to divorce lawyers and various other people who get involved in this sort of stuff. A lot of pranasa. If there's no bitul yesh, if a person is not willing to be mevatel something of his yeshus, if it has to be his way, if he's the only individual who understands, if it's not my way, then it's not going to work, then he's not going to get anywhere in life. And historically, yeshiva has been around for, 16 years? It's statistically a metzias. The guys who made it, quote unquote, and made it, in my mind, can be a guy who's today, and we have Baruch Hashem Talmidim, right? Massive Talmidei Chachomim. I was sitting in Lakewood, New Jersey, at a table some months ago, with four guys who are Lev Arya products, right? There are four guys who are learning now in BMG, right? They're all married, they're all Yindelites, right? I was sitting at a table with them. I was eating breakfast with them, right? Whatever you guys think you could, have, will, or imagine you've done, believe me, these guys were way, way past you guys. Way past. Your kids compared to these guys. And I asked Akasha. I had a kasha that was bothering me. And I asked the kasha. And all these guys shot me back on the spot without even thinking. One guy shot me back three gemaras straight away. It's a Mishnah here, it's a Tesis there, it's this there, this, this and that. Talmidei Chachamim muflogim. Muflogim. And as I walked out afterwards, I was saying to myself, how come these guys made it? These guys made it. These guys you have to stand up to because of the Yedi B'Torah. How come they made it? What do they have about them? These guys are wild as wild can be. The answer is they all had, that was the common theme, they all had one thing, bitterly-ish. You got to a point where they understood, okay, it's not working our way, let's try it your way. And the minute they said, okay, let's try it your way, everything became different. There's a system in the Bria. The Rebbeinu Shlom created man, and he created man as part of a system. And the system is that man, by nature, is an egoist. It's a messias. You're going to change it. But if you don't work on breaking that, if you don't work on the bitul ayesh, then you get absolutely nowhere in life. That's the message that the Torah is trying to give us in the parasha of Shkolim.